May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all our hearts be now and always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. We finish our sequence of Cambridge poets this evening, as I said at the beginning, by thinking about a living poet, a poet who is in fact a visiting fellow with us in college. And I hope we'll actually also have a sense, each of the sessions I've done, I've tried to make some threads of connection back from poet to poet as we've looked really going across the centuries and the generations. And I think there are some very particular threads of connections between our final poet in this sequence and some of the poets that we've dealt with earlier. As you will remember, I've begun every single one of these sessions with a little bit about when that poet came up to Cambridge and something of their life and adventures whilst undergraduates. I'm slightly hesitant as I do this now, partly because perhaps if Gwyneth wants to tell you interesting stories of her time in Girton in the late 70s, she can do so herself, but also because of, we happen to overlap. And for any interesting story I might suddenly want to tell, I'm sure she would be the keeper of several that could be told about me. So I may have to exercise circumspection. But I can tell you this, that she came up here to read English, and she delved deeply into that subject. I think she was one of those people who read literature and read poetry not in order to make essays or clever statements, although she was very good at that, but because it read her and because she connected deeply and wanted to make those inner connections and wanted to write and to continue and to actually add to the stock of the poetry that we have written for us in English. Though, having said that, when she first came up, the thing that we were all in awe of, those of us that got to know her, was that while still an undergraduate, she was already the Welsh language editor for Poetry Wales. And she was, I think at that time, writing in Welsh, and her first books of poetry were published in Welsh. It wasn't until 1995 that she published her first volume of poetry in English. So we were also well aware, those of us that were only Anglophone and didn't know any Welsh but loved some of it in translation, that there was a whole hinterland of rich and beautiful poetry, of resonance and inspiration that we had no access to. So we were a little jealous as well. Like other undergraduates, she had both the heights and the depths, and she's written, wrote a very good book later on called Sunbathing in the Rain about the struggle with depression, and she had certainly her dark times and her difficulties while she was here at Girton, which many Girtonians have, and it's part of my privilege as a chaplain sometimes to hear of the depths and the darknesses and the struggles. And occasionally, when I've been dealing with that and people have felt that they couldn't go on or that they wouldn't finally bear the fruit that was in them, that they felt frustrated and cut off and curtailed, and particularly those I've known here who've needed, as Gwyneth did, to take some time away from studies and come back. When I've been listening to those things, I've actually thought about her and thought about what can come through. So certainly, as with our other Cambridge poets, there are things about her time here to learn from, to empathise with, to take encouragement from, to be inspired by. Now, like anyone else reading the English Tripos, she will have covered and connected with all the poets I mentioned. In fact, she subsequently did some research work on Christopher Smart, whom we talked about in our second poet. I'd like just very briefly to make a thread of connection with each of the poets that we've previously looked at and with Gwyneth's work. She could, of course, be placed in an entirely Welsh tradition, and I'm not qualified to do that. I wish I could summon up the sainted soul of Donald Olchin, who died just recently, who wrote a great book on poetry in the Welsh tradition, and he could certainly, knew Gwyneth and could certainly place her in the Welsh tradition, as could Rowan Williams. But since neither of them is here, I'm going to leave the Welsh tradition suspended in the air. But within the English tradition, just going back to where we were, George Herbert, an Anglo-Welsh poet. In fact, Gwyneth is related to George Herbert. I think through the hedge, as the saying is, but there's something of the same family blood ties. And the first poem we're going to look at in a minute is a poem that she wrote, which has a deliberate resonance and connection with the poem we looked at in such detail of Herbert's poem, Prayer. So there's a deep connection there. Christopher Smart, I've already mentioned, she worked on, but Christopher Smart, as you know, went through a real periods of depression and doubt and difficulty, and yet was able in Jubilate Agno to express some of those depths and heights. And those who want to know more about some of those issues and read them in Gwyneth's work should read, I strongly commend, Sunbathing in the Rain, subtitled A Cheerful Book About Depression. And it certainly contributes to a whole genre, a very helpful genre of literature about dealing with those extremities in one's own mind. So I think there's a Christopher Smart connection there. Our next poet was Coleridge, after Christopher Smart, and there the resonances become deeper still. It would be easy to say, well, there's an obvious connection there, that Coleridge wrote the Rime of the Ancient Mariner about extraordinary and in some senses stormy and unfortunate voyages, and Gwyneth has written Two in a Boat and has taken to sailing, and for her the sea and sailing have also become profoundly resonant metaphors about both inner and outer voyaging, about the individual voyage, the voyage of the couple. So you could, but I think that the connection goes deeper still. There's a wonderful passage in a recent volume, which I want to talk about as well, Hospital Odyssey, where she raises up Coleridge's great distinction between imagination and fancy. Fancy being merely playing about with fixities and definites, dreaming up clever schemes of, as it were, arbitrary and intellectually forced correspondences. That's fancy. But imagination is about grasping that the very shape of things itself, all that is out there in the cosmos, grows and is shaped organically by the very same force and power whereby human works and works of creation and of art can also be grown and shaped organically, that the same creative powers, the same shaping spirit of imagination, as Coleridge put it, are at work both in here and out there, that there are connections and resonances between in here and out there, that the imagination at the deepest level can look out there and see patterned and worked out in lucid symbols a key to the heart of what's in here, and the other way around. Indeed, Coleridge, in his great essay on poesy, considered as one of the fine arts, said, to make the outer inner and the inner outer, that is the essence of genius in the fine arts. So a deep distinction between imagination and fancy, and a putting of oneself at the service of imagination, a recognition that imagination is a truth-bearing faculty. That, I think, is actually a key theme and a key to understanding Gwyneth's poetry as well as Coleridge's. But the poet we looked at after that, I suggested, was one of the very first poets in English to take the new science, not the old beautiful models of the seven spheres and the fixed stars and all the lovely models that Dante and co. had looked at of the cosmos that were so ringing and resonant and full of Christian assurance, but to begin to look at the new models of science, the vast distances in space and time opened up by cosmology and by the sciences of evolution and of geology. And I talked a little bit about how important it was that Tennyson did that. Well, that perhaps par excellence is what Gwyneth's poetry about and what she's particularly known for. She's had times, as it were, as kind of poet in residence in various scientific institutions and in hospitals. The kind of people that she acknowledges and gives thanks to for helping her poetry are not great sort of doyens of literature, but great scientists. people who are on the cutting edge of biological sciences, of physics, of cosmology. And she's somebody who has really tried to bring the poetic imagination to bear on the fruits and findings of science, recognizing that science itself is also a work of the poetic imagination, and that perhaps more deeply still, the cosmos which science observes, both outwardly and inwardly, rings and resonates with truths to which only the imagination has access. So, in some ways, it's good to finish with Gwyneth's poetry, not only because she's here in our midst and it's nice to celebrate that, but because in some ways the things she writes actually bring together the themes I've been trying to adumbrate over this series. I mentioned George Herbert, and so I'd like to begin by reading you a poem of Gwyneth's called Homecoming. It's from Parables and Faxes, published in 1995. It's one of a sequence, so you'd need to look at the whole sequence to get lots of the things in it. But do you remember that poem, Prayer, by George Herbert? Do you remember how it was just a list of phrases? It's called Prayer, but it went prayer, the church's banquet, angel's age, God's breath in man returning to his birth, the soul in paraphrase, heart in pilgrimage. Just little phrases, and I mentioned that phrase of Heaney's, Seamus Heaney's, where he said, poetry gives you phrases that feed the soul, single phrases that somehow to sum up and give you a picture of something you wouldn't otherwise grasp. Well, think now of that poem and then listen to this one, and perhaps have a little more than just prayer in your mind. Perhaps you can think about meditation. Perhaps you can think about being still. Perhaps you can think about forms of spirituality that don't necessarily carry all the baggage of Christian doctrine, but are nevertheless about a kind of spiritual stillness and centering. Here is Homecoming. I wonder which of these phrases might resonate with your inner spiritual experience. Two rivers deepening into one. Less said, more meant. A field of corn adjusting to harvest. A battle won by yielding. Days emptied to their brim. An autumn, a wedding, a logarithm. Self-evidence earned. A coming home to something brand new, but always known. Not doing, but being. A single noun. Now in infinity. A fortune found in all that's disposable. Not out there, but in. The ceremonials of light in the rain. The power of being nothing but sane. You'll catch many of the resonances, finishes in a way like something understood. One of the things that vicars and chaplains struggle with is the problem of pious language, the language of Zion, using terms that are only resonant in the church and not beyond. Gwyneth, in this poem, it seems to me, manages to speak of some of the same realities of which church language speaks without ever using church language. So Herbert's heaven in ordinary becomes now in infinity. Rites and rituals of church that Herbert writes about become something you might glimpse just as the sun comes out after rain, wherever you were, in church or not, the ceremonials of light in the rain. So I commend that to you. I've often used that poem both myself and with others on retreats alongside the Herbert poem, and people have found it extremely helpful as both an expression of and a source for the fruits of their meditation. But I mentioned that the engagement with science is a really key element to Gwyneth's work. And obviously a key element, if we are to make our faith real, our faith must always be open to and engage with science. I've given you the prologue from Zero Gravity. Zero Gravity is both a book and a sequence. In that sequence, There are three things going on at the same time which are interwoven. Somebody is dying in a hospital room. A comet is going past at a great speed and to a great distance, and bound up in the light, the combination of light and coldness in the comet, are remnants of and emblems of an intense relationship. And also, somebody is going up in the space shuttle to repair the Hubble Space Telescope, going out into that void and coming back again. In fact, Gwyneth's cousin has gone up as an astronaut to do that repair. And actually, the repair of the telescope and the... You remember they'd sent it up there at great expense, but it wasn't in focus. We weren't getting back the pictures clear enough. So something had to be done outwardly and visibly there to do it so that we could see. And in fact, the whole sequence in that book is about seeing. And it's also about love and distance. It's about the sense of closeness to people and the question of whether when people are physically further away, they're any less close to you. What is distance in relation to love? And ultimately, of course, it's the question about death and resurrection. And we had the Lazarus reading because there's a wonderful moment later on in that poem where she compares the man coming back from space and coming out of the capsule in which she's been, as it were, sent off to apparent death and buried, because, of course, there are all those fears about previous space shuttle things, coming back and people wanting to touch his body as one imagines they might have wanted to do with Lazarus. Let me just draw out one or two phrases that have stayed with me and might be a key for other reading of her poetry. Love's an attack on time. It's wonderful. Love attacking and in some sense breaking up, perhaps overcoming time. My theme is change. My point of view, ecstatic. Ecstasy means literally being outside oneself, outside of one's body, looking in. But of course it carries that other, perhaps religious as well as erotic sense of ecstasy. My point of view, ecstatic. And then distance is a matter of seeing, faith, a science of feeling faint objects. That's interesting that the desire to see. There's a kind of playing there with a biblical text about faith is the evidence of things not seen. So the sequence goes on and finishes, the prologue finishes with this interesting image of above us the sky sees with its trillion, trillion eyes. There are elements in both the little poems I've quoted there that are brought back and explored in much greater depth in the book Gwyneth published last year, A Hospital Odyssey, which is a wonderful story. I'm going to quote you a very beautiful and elevated part of it, but it's full of all kinds of things, satire and humour and wit, and it's got lots of interesting characters, including a wonderful dog called Wilson. But it's also a kind of reversed story, going back to the Lazarus story, the looking for the person who's gone, the trying to call them back. It reverses, actually, in some ways, the story of Orpheus and Eurydice, whereas Orpheus, the man, goes off to find the woman who has been taken down to the underworld. In this case, it's the woman, Maris, the heroine, who is looking for Hardy, who has been taken away from her in a hospital and is being taken away by the processes of cancer. And she explores both inner and outer space to try and find him again. Her love is an attack on time. Her love takes her into and out of distance. Her love completely explodes the normal categories. She travels in all kinds of times and modes and ways. She's both within him and beyond him. And the whole poem is told from her point of view until the moment I've given you here, which is the one part I want to finish with, really without further comment. Although it picks up very beautifully the little phrase in Homecoming, not out there but in. The outer and inner. There's a point of turning in the final, the last of the 12 books, in which, having seen everything from Maris, the woman's point of view, we suddenly see things from the point of view of Hardy, the man that she's gone to look for, if you like, the Lazarus that she's calling out. And in this passage, a great deal of science suddenly seems to me to be illuminated from within by imaginative intuition and shot through with meaning. I'll just close by reading this. This is what Hardy saw. from his dying. Maris bending over him. And behind her, the vibrant, dazzling core of the sun, rich and red as hemochrome at 15 million degrees. He was overcome by the knowledge that everything out there was in truth his own body. We are filaments of light. We're talking with everywhere at once. And we were never meant to be thought of as single lines to be bent in the space-time continuum. That's prose. No, it's more like the drive of poetry. It's as when I rhyme, there's always a nanosecond before I've chosen a word when I perceive all its homophones at once before the end word's probability wave collapses, before I take a chance on one meaning, when my mind revolves with the quantum mechanics that makes stars evolve from the tiniest jitters. We are born to catastrophe. Galaxies fly away from each other in identical forms. Matter never sees fit to die. And if life is the transfer of energy from one state to another, this poem from me to you, then this continual exchange must be our purpose. Infinity's birdsong continues just beyond the range of our human hearing. Love is the hinge on which it all turns. Amen.